Your New York weekend is not complete without the Joan Hamburg Show on 77 WABC.
All right, everyone. Settle down because you are now officially part of the Joan Hamburg Show. And by the way, we podcast too. So you can always find us on podcast. And we do great new original shows. I'm looking forward to having you join us. And we're on Facebook and we're on Twitter. And today, in just a second, few minutes, we're going to take you to the hottest new restaurants that are opening in New York City. And everyone loves to have the inside scoop. We'll get to help you get a reservation just by your knowing about them before anywhere else. And then our pal Ben Brantley from the New York Times is going to take you through all the theater opportunities. They're all starting to come in, and also great way to start and go to a preview. But a couple of things, all of you asking me, all right, what should we do over a weekend? There's a lot of cultural centers here that people don't know about: the Japan Society, the German Institute, the Austrian Forum, the French Institute. We've got tons of them, and they almost all offer language classes, have events that are open to the public, cooking classes, and a lot of them have restaurants. Scandinavian House at 58 Park Avenue, they have a really good restaurant called Smorgas Chef at 212-686-4230. That's the leading center for Nordic culture in America. So in addition to the events, you can go to this restaurant. They have their own farm, so they have yummy farm fresh goodies. Try their tasting plate, gravlax and meatballs and herring, $22. The Swedish meatballs are heaven. And they're open for brunch on weekends, lunch and dinner every day of the week. So it's fun, and learn the language. Later on, as we continue to do more and more, I'll take you through a lot of the cultural centers and the secret restaurants that they have within them. But meanwhile, stay tuned because we have a great show coming up. Thank you so much for being here. I'm Joan Hamburg, 770 on the dial.
New York culture with real New Yorkers. Joan Hamburg, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
Welcome to the Joan Hamburg Show. My guest is Ken Starr. And Ken Starr, in my world, was a household name for many, many years. Ken was the independent counsel investigating the Clinton administration, and he did that for 94 to 99. He also was Solicitor General under George H.W. Bush. He was a law clerk to Warren Berger of the Supreme Court. He's had a very distinguished and is having a career, head of Baylor University, dean of the Pepperdine School of Law, and a book, Contempt, a memoir of the Clinton investigation. And it's very interesting for the book to come out at this time, because among the people who worked for Ken Starr is a man who is probably going to be the next Supreme Court Justice, Brett Kavanaugh. So I'm curious. I read the book, and I have to issue a disclaimer that I have known the Clintons for a very long time and, you know, have spent several occasions over the years with them. But there were so many things that are so relevant today that I really thought it was important. But I'm curious, Ken Starr, what made you decide to do this at this time? Was it painful looking back at not only the glory years, but the years where you were like the villain?
Well, Joan, thank you for having me on. Yeah, there was some pain in recalling it, and I'd not wanted to write the book. I'd been encouraged for many years. especially soon after leaving the investigation so long ago, hey, you got to write your side of the story. And I said, I don't think so. I want to live my life and so forth. But several things happened. One, I had finished my work at Baylor University on less than totally happy circumstances, but I loved Baylor. And I immediately wrote a book. This is in 2016. About my Baylor experience, and it was just a love story to Baylor, which I, again, I continue to love today. And then as I was finishing that project and not wanting to just return to the practice of law, although I'm now doing a good deal of that, but in any event, I so enjoyed that, Joan, that I said, what's my next writing project? And then, you know, to my surprise, obviously to the surprise of a lot of people, Hillary lost the election. And then I knew the 20-year anniversary was coming up. I don't want to rain on anybody's parade. I want my president to succeed, whether I voted for that president or not. So if Hillary had won the election, who knows whether I'd have written it. But all those things came together, Joan, and I said, you know, this is really the right time. It's either now or probably never that you would look back on that period and reflect on it. But especially then it became so topical because the air became acrid with impeachment talk.
Exactly.
All over again. Just say no to all this nonsense about impeachment. Have elections, but don't do it.
I know. Don't do it, because certainly those of us who were, you know, very much involved at that time, it was a trauma to everyone. And it also was a trauma to you and to your family.
Oh, it was horrible. Just horrible for everyone involved. And, you know, if we had settled down and had a conversation, and I really mean 435 members of the House of Representatives and 100 senators, there was a voice that I think was not listened to and should have, and among others. Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, then as now. And Senator Feinstein said, we need to find a way of condemning what the president did. And we're not talking about the morality of the relationship. Get rid of that whole subject. No. We're talking about his violations of the criminal law, which were proven beyond a reasonable doubt. What do? We can't just overlook that. And so she proposed a resolution of censure. And if people had been able to come together, and they just weren't, to say, yeah, you know, that may be the right resolution. We shouldn't overlook what the president did. He took an oath, et cetera. He encouraged others to lie. He denies that to this day. But he did. We proved all that. And I don't say that to be harsh. It's just that's the reality. So how do you deal with reality? And I think a resolution of censure, and I say all this in the book, Joan, might have been the way to go. So that may be the conversation that we're going to have, depending on what happens at the midterm elections and the like.
Right now. And it's hard to believe that we are going or can go through this again. And when you read Ken Starr's book, it's called Contempt, Ken, which was really interesting to me because, truthfully, in those years, I was so angry at you, but I didn't even know, you know, we just see what's depicted in front of us. So it was really fascinating to read about your growing up and the path that you took. You were practically a kid. You've been a federal appeals judge, a solicitor general, and then they came to you and said, would you be the guy to take over the Clinton investigation? And you, a public service person your whole life, had a lot of doubts, but agreed to do it. And I think, you know, it's easy to look back and say, never should have. But you can't do that. We can't rewrite history.
No, that's exactly right. And you're right. I mean, this is not something, the investigation, I didn't apply for it. I didn't want it. It's sort of a take this job and shove it. But the three judges under the law at that time, the appointed independent counsel, said, we want you to do this job. And I'd been very, very blessed, Joan, to have different assignments over the years, which I didn't deserve. I mean, who knows who deserves what, but I certainly did not deserve to hold the positions that I held and had the opportunities that I did. So, you know, I love my country. We all love our country. We just have strong views about what is the right direction for our country. But we all love, that's why we're so passionate. We love the country. So I think those who love the country, as we all do, I hope we all do, then say, okay, it's time for me to take one for the team.
Right. And it's interesting that, you know, in going back, that Brett Kavanaugh worked for you, and he was the guy on the Vince Foster case during those years, and almost seemed obsessed with it.
well, because
it was his job.
Well, Brett just, Judge Kavanaugh, the future judge, did such a great and thorough job, and I think we put to rest, Joan, all the, I mean, anybody can say anything, but in terms of conspiracy theories with any legs to them, you know, we chopped those legs off, and Brett did a great job. I'm the one who became a bit, well, I use the word haunted by Vince Foster. I never knew him, but I had the sense that I came to know him, and I explain this in the book. This is one of the most tragic things about, and I know you know them and you love them, but Vince Foster Jr. was a terrible tragedy of the Clintons.
Explain, just so we can remind the audience. Vince Foster was with the Clintons in Arkansas. I'm going to let you take it from there.
Yeah. Vince was Hillary's law partner. They were very close. Vince was a true gentleman, very able, successful lawyer, and he comes to Washington to serve as the deputy White House counsel. He was Hillary's choice. I mean, Bill knew him, but he didn't have the relationship professionally with the president because he really wasn't a political guy. He was a law guy. So he comes in, and within 7 months, he takes his own life. I mean, this is amazing. This is the most tragic kind of story. So why? And my own view, it's my own theory, and I lay this out. This isn't a conspiracy theory. What we know is the records from the law firm where Hillary and Vince and Webster Hubbell practiced law together represented Madison Guaranty Savings and Loan, which was the corrupt, fraud-infected savings and loan owned by Bill and Hillary's partners in Whitewater, Madison Guaranty Savings and Loan. What we know is that the billing records that showed that Hillary had, in fact, done legal work, significant legal work for Madison Guaranty Savings and Loan, were stolen. The records were stolen from the Rose Law Firm. And then those records eventually turned up in Washington, D.C., at the White House, in Hillary's book room, where she was writing It Takes a Village. And when finally they were turned over, and they'd been under subpoena, so there's an obstruction of justice element, purloining for the pre-electronic record days. Those are the only records. And so my own theory is, bless his heart and God rest his soul, Vince Foster Jr. was involved in obstruction of justice.
Although we'll never really know. Ken Starr is my guest. Looking back, doing this book, looking at what happened many years ago, looking at what's going on now, character and sex and the presidency. Can you really still have a strong presidency with a little weak moral center somewhere?
Well, it looks as if we're going to have to learn how to deal with that, especially in the age of information where...
like too much.
But sometimes it's too much information. Mm-hmm. So, I think we're struggling with that. We're in an age of transition. Can presidents have a successful presidency in the age of this robust social media? I say yes, they can. They can accomplish things, but it just puts an extra burden on them to, you know, turn square corners, as we say. Don't jaywalk. Do the best you can to, you know, exercise self-control and so forth. And obviously, President Clinton had so many strengths and so many abilities, such charm, such charisma, such intelligence.
To this day, he can make butter melt.
Exactly.
I've watched him in Republican, strictly Republican areas. And I was in, I think it was Montana, Wyoming, I don't even remember anymore. And he was in town. And all the grumbling of the local people who, we don't want him, it was a Republican area. He comes in, he gets to the little lectern, gives a little talk, and they're like, on their knees. Definitely has a gift. Let me ask you something else, Ken. Yep. Ken, sure. Who has had an extraordinary career as a lawyer, let's, you know, forget the Clinton thing for a minute, a judge, a solicitor general, and the op-ed page story in the New York Times, which broke such news. That writer, whomever it is that a crime in your head?
No, unless it's, no, it's not. I think it's a cowardly act, because the right thing to do, if you feel as strongly as the writer feels, is to resign and then say what you're going to say, as opposed to continuing to serve. So I view that as ironic, but it's not a crime.
Not a crime. And you describe in the book, it's a small part, but I think it was a Christmas Eve. You were in a little place in Greenwich Village in New York City, and you ran into Monica Lewinsky, and she was not someone that you had personally known, right, even during all that investigation.
Yeah, we had never met. It was just so ironic. So it was Christmas Eve, and we had the early seating. I've got family here that live in the West Village, so we're at this wonderful restaurant. So I'm trying to get three generations of my family out of the restaurant into cabs so we could get over for Christmas Eve services. And we were running just a little bit late, but that's the context in which I saw Monica. And we had the exchange. It was very brief. If I call it a poignant exchange, because I wish her well. What hell she went through. And of course, she blames me. And my response to that is,
she's been loyal no matter what happened to her.
Yeah.
She remained faithful and loyal.
Absolutely.
Even to this day.
Even to this day. And so my response to that is, Monica, golly, you engaged in criminal conduct. You can't overlook that. And then I was authorized and directed by Attorney General Janet Reno and the special division of the three-judge court to look into whether the President of the United States was committing perjury, obstructing justice, and the like. This is serious business. So, you know, there's the personal, and I understand that. You'll never get over a personal perspective, the deep wounds and the deep hurt. But there's another perspective, there's another lens, and that is welcome to our nation, which is a rule of law, and no one can be above the law.
All right, let me ask you, Linda Tripp, the name, now my producers are young, so they probably still don't even know who Linda Tripp is, but she was one of Monica's close work-related friends who spilled the beans and secretly taped her on. Whatever happened to Linda Tripp?
Yeah, she's living her life in suburban Virginia. I think she ended up having a store or something like that. I've not talked to Linda Tripp, you know, since the investigation.
Well, many years, right.
Yeah, many years. But the brief point on that is that people say, well, how did all this come about? But it brings us back to Vince Foster, because Linda Tripp, destined to become Monica's friend, and as Monica would say, my betrayer, you know.
Right. Well, you don't need friends like that.
No friends like that. Had been Vince Foster's executive assistant in the White House.
See, people, I think, did not realize or do not if they go back to that time. So Ken Starr, a memoir of very tumultuous period in his life called Contempt, had a whole different career bent. Could have been on the bench, though you never know. Stranger things have happened. If you had to look into your crystal ball, what would you see in the future? You mentioned the impeachment word.
Yeah. Well, I'm really hoping, and honestly, in my faith tradition, I'm praying that cooler heads will prevail. with respect to impeachment. I was very pleased to see that Nancy Pelosi, who may be the next Speaker of the House, but she's certainly a very, very, very important leader on now the minority side. But if the Democrats move into the majority, you need voices like that to say, don't go there. It's overly divisive. It didn't work when the shoe was on the other foot. So I hope that cooler heads will prevail, and I think they will. And here's the thing. Even if articles of impeachment are returned, I don't see, given what we now know, now who knows what might come out, and I understand that, I don't see two-thirds of the Senate voting to remove Donald Trump from office. It just, that means you've got to have significant Republican support.
Okay. Very interesting. Thank you for your time, Ken Starr. All the best to your family.
Thank you. Thank you, Joan. I appreciate your time.
I'm Joan Hamburg. Ken has a book called Contempt, a memoir of the Clinton investigations. And as I said to Ken, no secret, I've known the Clintons a long time. I am a fan. And to this day, I remain in their camp. But really interesting to read Times that had an impact on so many of us and changed this man's life. I'm Joan Hamburg, and you're listening to WABC.
Backstage with Broadway's Best, Behind the Curtain with Joan Hamburg on 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
Welcome to the Joan Hamburg Show. And, of course, now that we're officially in fall, we're taking a look at all the things we want to do. And we get called, even earlier than this, theater. What should I see? What should I get tickets for? And I turned to probably the most influential theater critic in the country, New York Times' own Ben Brantley. And Ben not only gives us New York, but he gives us London. And a lot of what he talks about often comes here. So you've got a heads up. How are you, Ben?
I'm very well, Joan. How about you?
I'm good. And you're getting ready for the whole new season to be upon us?
Yeah, I'm steeling myself for the arrival of, Monsters and Cher. And
right. King Kong. How King is King Kong going?
$35 million and a giant animatronic ape.
Wow.
Who I think, I gather, does not sing, you know, the way most Broadway stars sing. He provides ape-like noises set to kind of surreal music.
Well, it sounds interesting. Probably a couple of hundred bucks a ticket.
A long time in the making, too. It's been 10 years, various productions. I know it's had a series of different writers, but, you know, you kind of have to be curious.
That's right. It is something we've all known about forever, this poor ape and how he survives in the Big Apple.
Yes, yes. Are you going to have a selfie taken with him?
Well, of course. Ben, who wouldn't? So let's get back to the real world where Sarah Bernhardt, one of the great actresses.
Sarah Bernhardt doing Hamlet, played by one of our generation's great actresses, Janet McTeer.
Oh, love her.
Won a Tony for doing the best doll's house I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. Here in a new play by Teresa Rebeck called Bernhardt Hamlet. And that, you know, how could it not be be exciting? I'd see Janet McTeer in pretty much anything.
Me too.
The prospect of her as Sarah Bernhardt is especially
interesting.
Yeah, titillating.
All right, we all like her. And there are plays coming in like The Nap.
Nap, I'm looking forward to. That's Richard Bean, best known here for having given us the play that made James Corden an international star, One Man, Two Governors.
Yeah.
One of the funniest plays I've surely
Same.
Ever seen.
Me too. Loved it and loved him as a result.
Oh, yeah, tremendous. And this is about the rarefied art of snooker, which we know more as pool, I suppose. Don't know anything about it, except I've heard it's funny, and it has to be, I would assume, with those credentials. And also coming in from London, a play I loved when I saw it there at the Royal Court Theatre, subsequently transferred to the West End, is Jez Butterworth's The Ferryman. And Jez Butterworth is the guy who gave us the magnificent Jerusalem, starring Mark Rylance, not so very long ago. And this is about a family during the period known as the Troubles in Ireland. Its legacy remains. It has a huge cast, directed by Sam Mendes, the great Sam Mendes, and the cast includes babies and ducks and
wow,
it's all there. And it's just a bursting with life. It's one of the most exciting plays I've seen in a while, so I'm looking forward to that again.
And that's coming in October, but of course it's going to preview very shortly.
Preview shortly, yeah. That's one I would say. It's long. It's more than 3 hours, but it goes so fast, and you feel very stimulated by it all the way through.
And what do you hear about, with another strange name, The Lifespan of a Fact?
Well, it's certainly topical at a time when we're wondering just what facts in journalism are and how much they can be trusted. It sounds quite esoteric. It's about, it's taken from a real account of a man who wrote an essay for The Atlantic, I believe, and initially, and had quite a wrestling match with his fact checker. Now, the fact checker in this case is being played by Daniel Radcliffe, the writer by Bobby Cannavale, and the editor of the bosses of the fact checker by fact checker is Cherry Jones.
Oh, what a cast.
I mean, that's quite a trifecta of talent.
And then The Prom. Now, have you seen or heard anything like a high school deal?
Yeah, it sounds, again, very topical. It's about an Indiana teenager who wants to bring her girlfriend to the prom, and a crew of Broadway performers sweeps in to support her. It's by the people who did The Drowsy Chaperone. I saw, actually, The Times had a fall season preview at Joe's Pub at the Public Theater.
Uh-huh.
In August, and there was Beth Level, who was in The Drowsy Chaperone, won a Tony for it, sang a number for it, and it's, you know, you can't judge by one song, but it sounded pretty infectious, so it should be upbeat. We seem to have a lot of teen musicals
right
around us now, including Be More Chill. I don't know if you saw that. When it was off Broadway at Second Stage, not Second Stage, sorry, at the Signature Center, and it's moving to Broadway, and it's a hit by virtue of social media. It never really got great reviews. It was first seen in New Jersey, but kids of a certain age, say, you know,
they couldn't resist.
And it sold out even before it opened off Broadway. And so they're going to see if that translates into strong sales on Broadway.
Well, that is going to be interesting. And I wanted to ask you about a play that people said is really funny, but it's about something that isn't funny, The Waverly Gallery.
Oh, I loved that the first time I saw it. It's by Kenneth Lonergan, one of my favorite playwrights, I think one of the great American playwrights working today, probably best known to large audiences for the movie Manchester by the Sea. But it's about a woman, it's basically about his grandmother.
Who had Alzheimer's
and ran a gallery in Greenwich Village. The first time I saw it, it's performed by Eileen Heckert. And this time, it's performed by Elaine May, the great Elaine.
Oh, we love her.
I know. So it sounds like it should be depressing, but
it's not.
Kenneth Lonergan has a way of finding the poetry in the way everybody speaks. And in those strange sort of patterns of wayward thought that comes with having dementia, he creates something kind of beautiful, I think. I'll be really eager to see this.
Oh, I can't wait. And then closing out sort of the initial group of openings, To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, yeah, much anticipated. I mean, there have been some disputes between the Harper Lee Estate and the producer Scott Wooten over whether it fairly represented the novel and so forth. And, of course, Harper Lee has been so much in the news again in recent years with the sequel, the much-debated sequel that came out later and also became a bestseller. But it's got Jeff Daniels in the role
so
that most people associate with Gregory Peck from the film version. He won an Academy Award for it. And he is kind of my idea of Atticus Finch. It sounds like perfect casting, doesn't it, as the decent. But I think he'll add some, a decent Southern lawyer, I think he'll add some layers of complexity to it. He's a really fine stage actor, as anyone who knows who saw him in Blackbird.
Well, I can't wait to see that. You know, funny, I was at a birthday lunch yesterday, women, and they were mostly asking about the Cher show.
Ah.
And they seemed surprised to hear that Cher was not in the Cher show.
No, it's three other Chers.
Exactly.
People embodying Cher in different aspects of real life. We've had so many jukebox musicals recently. Probably the best of them is Beautiful, the Carole King.
Yeah, that works.
Won Jesse Mueller Tony Award. We had this past season, we had the Donna Summer musical. And now, by golly, we have Cher. So, I think the entire world, I mean, there's something irresistible about Cher, about the very notion of Cher. I mean, whether this will be the next Mamma Mia, we'll have to see.
Yeah, it's going to be. Is Cher involved?
I don't know. I mean, I think she's aware of it, and, you know, she's looked at it and all that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, she's not actually, of course, appearing in it.
Right, which is a surprise to a lot of people there. Oh, I'm going to get tickets. Cher's coming to Broadway.
Yeah, no, I know. It'd be kind of great if she did it the way Bruce Springsteen did.
Yeah.
Took over the stage by herself.
Such a good idea. Well, the next life. I always thought she would be great when Bette Midler left for the first time. I thought that would be a good place to put Cher.
Oh, in Hello, Dolly, yeah. I could definitely see her doing that.
Well, it didn't happen.
No, she's never been on Broadway. Oh, yes, I don't know, she wasn't. That was off Broadway. But she did appear on a New York stage and come back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean,
yeah,
years ago when Robert Altman directed it, which really sort of gave her new credibility as an actress. So it all connects. And
it does.
And circles.
And we've got a lot to look forward to. It seems like a lot of good things coming in now, which you might think is a little bit early because the Tonys are not until June. However, it's good for us.
Yes, it's excellent. Floodgates are open, and off-Broadway, too. There's a lot of interesting stuff. You can see Glenn Close as the mother of Joan of Arc at the Public Theater. Glenn Close in close quarters, I would think, would always be worth it, in a play called Mother of the Maid. And there's a very interesting reworked version of Oklahoma, a rather dark, topical Oklahoma. Small cast that I saw at Bard a couple of summers ago that's coming to St. Anne's Warehouse. So,
wow.
Everywhere you look, there's
something.
Yeah.
Right? Well, I'm so happy, and I'm glad you're with us. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you so much.
Take care. I'm Joan Hamburg with Ben Brantley, New York Times major theater critic, giving you a heads up on what seems like almost everything is worth seeing. Well, in my world, almost everything is worth seeing. So enjoy. And we're going to take a break, and we'll be back after this. Joan Hamburg from WABC.
From food to fun and so much more, The Joan Hamburg Show, exclusively on 77 WABC.
All right, everyone, we love food, and we love reading about food, and no one does it better than the New York Times' own Florence Fabricant, who covers the scene, whether it's new food trends, new products, restaurants. She does a really great job. And, of course, a new season, lots of openings this fall, and Florence has sampled as many as she can. And she's thin, too, which is incredibly annoying. Welcome to you, Florence Fabricant.
Thank you, Joan. I'm going to sneak off into a corner. It's bad enough to have a hurricane named for you, but well.
Yeah, but it's fantastic. And Florence cooks, too. It's not only that she has a very delicate and sophisticated palate. She's a cook. So let's talk about what's going on in the world of food. Lots of Asian restaurants still, right?
Right, yeah. And especially Korean. I think that over the past number of years, Korean has gone from what one considers as so-called ethnic cuisine, with little Korea towns dotting some cities and cookbooks devoted to Korean food, to becoming part of the mainstream. And it's really exciting to see Korean ingredients and style and that kind of thing in the kitchen of people who shop in supermarkets and can now find gochujang.
I know. It's so interesting. I'm talking to Florence Fabricant, who's a food and wine writer for the New York Times. She writes the front burner of the menu. She talks about what's great alongside of wine. And we're taking a look because, like theater, people start calling us. Where should we go? Should we try to make reservations now? So we're talking about Korean food, which Florence said is coming in big at this point. And what else? The West Side, which always had a lot of restaurants, but people who live there and love food would go to other places to eat. And that's changing.
Well, partly because until you are in the Lincoln Center area, the Upper West Side, let's say above 72nd Street or even 65th Street, was considered to be not a place with restaurants that would draw people who lived outside the neighborhood. They were really neighborhood places. And unlike a lot of other areas of the city, like the Lower East Side or Williamsburg, Brooklyn, they didn't really attract people who traveled to eat. But I think that is changing now because there have been a few significant openings and more coming. And
right.
As an Upper West Sider, I can tell you I'm excited.
I don't blame you, but, and I'm trying to remember, is that restaurant that is going into where Dovetail used to be,
mm-hmm.
is that from Philly?
Well, the chef.
Because I think I ate in
owner,
his restaurant.
Adam Leonti. Was the was a chef at Vetri in Philadelphia.
Right. And good food.
A marvelous restaurant.
Yeah, I was going to say really good. So that's a welcome addition to your neighborhood. Is he up and ready now or coming in?
I would give him probably till the end of October.
To do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's really exciting because he's a very serious chef.
Yeah.
And
but his idea is to make this an accessible restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
He wants, and this is the goal of lots and lots of people in this business, that it not just be a special occasion place.
Right, that you can go in. Well, that's what every neighborhood needs. Where you can go in and really enjoy food no matter what, just even if you're coming home from work and you're hungry.
Right.
So, and I also read downtown on 12th Street, Balabusta.
Yeah, well, in a way, Aynat Admani, who opened Balabusta, mm-hmm. which put her name on the map, and then she opened these little falafel places called Tame.
Right.
And then has Kishkash, which is for couscous, handmade couscous, mm-hmm. and Barabolanat. But she's been kind of playing musical restaurants because she closed Balabusta and now is reopening it in the space that had been Barabolanat.
Wow.
In the West Village.
And what about Mama Fuka, the noodle bar and Bang Bar and the Time Warner Center?
That's interesting.
Tell
That's
me
an
about
interesting
that.
Interesting addition because, I mean, it's a real leap for David Chang going that far uptown and into a complex
mm-hmm.
of not just high-end shops, but
restaurants
as well. And I hope he does well.
Yeah, and is it going to be high-priced as usual, or?
Well, when he says noodle,
mm-hmm.
I don't think you expect something on the order of Momofuku Ko. I think it will be accessible.
Okay.
How much can you charge for noodles?
Well,
after
we
all?
Know. They charge plenty. You have to really chew slowly. And have you tried, and I haven't done that yet, but it was on the list, that fried chicken that everyone was talking about at the usual?
I have not yet.
It sounded really interesting from this
yeah.
chef who was famous for his eggs because my L.A. kid had always told me about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So now in New York with a fried chicken. But fried chicken, again, it's like all of a sudden, everyone's into fried chicken.
Well, Daniel Delaney, who made his name actually with barbecue and has gone into fried chicken, is moving his fried chicken place and opening in Brooklyn in the DeKalb Market Hall, which is an incredible complex of food stalls.
Mm. There's a lot to do and a lot to eat. So, Florence, if you were telling people who plan this like they do going to theater or concerts and go out, not like many of us in New York too often, but a couple of times, of the new crop coming in, what three might you think is really worth trying?
Well, then you're asking me about my crystal ball. And
you're good at that.
I mean, I do think that Adam Leonti's restaurant that's replacing Dovetail.
Right, on the west side.
Yeah, is something that really will be worth trying, for starters. This Madame Vo barbecue.
Yeah, I read about that one.
The couple who owns Madame Vo, the Vietnamese mm-hmm. restaurant in the East Village, now they're opening a barbecue place, Vietnamese barbecue, and I'm really looking forward to that. I'm also, I would like to get out to see what Missy Robbins is doing with pasta at her new place in Williamsburg called Mizi. And can't wait for Pisolino from Jody Williams and Rita Sodi to open, because I just love all the food they do.
And where is that opening?
That's opening on the corner of 7th Avenue South and Grove. It's almost across
downtown.
The street from their restaurant Via Carota.
Right. Okay, so which is another interesting thing, that chefs no longer chef at one restaurant. If they're really successful, they expand into a few.
Well, it's the economy of scale.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to keep a little mom and pop in business these days because of the demands of the expenses, the cost of food, the wages, mm-hmm. health care for your employees,
right.
rent, utilities. It all keeps going up and up and up.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to open a restaurant and you're new at this, it would be, I think, reasonable to say that you should have enough money to run for a year and a half to 2 years before you make a dime.
Wow.
In order to stay in business.
That's tough, right?
It is tough. And, you know, people, but the thing is that there are often lots of people who want to back a restaurant because they feel this becomes their restaurant.
Uh-huh, they can get a seat.
They can get a seat, but they have a vested interest, and nobody wants to see these places go out of business.
That's for sure. And it keeps neighborhoods strong. Maybe I read about it through you, Tiki Chick on Amsterdam Avenue and 85th Street. Does that ring a bell?
Amsterdam and 85th?
Right.
It isn't yet. That's going to be a tiki bar.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're in the mood for that sort
of
thing.
Yeah, it should be interesting. Well, I'm excited to sample what you've suggested. We'll talk to you very soon. Florence Fabrican from the New York Times, talking about what's going to be a really busy restaurant season. Thanks, Florence.
Thank you, Joan, and have a great fall season.
You too. I'm Joan Hamburg, and you're listening to WABC.